Well, gardening can be such a fun and relaxing activity, but it isn't without its challenges. Last year, we had to deal with extremes of heat and dryness, and this year, we had to sneak our plantings in between rainstorms and despite the cool temperatures. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Patty Nagai is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, and she knows so much about successfully growing vegetables, fruits, flowers, and much more. Patty, thanks as always for spending time with us.
You're welcome, Judith. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it seems to be leveling off a bit now, but a lot of the state got much more rain than we're used to early on. What impacts have you seen on gardens as a result of that?
It slowed people down a little bit in getting into their gardens and doing some of the normal spring activities. You know, it's really not fun to garden in mud, and it's really bad for your soil. So we discourage mudding in plants, and so it's good to work with a well-drained, highly friable soil before you start planting and doing all of that. However, nice moist soil is great for pulling weeds, especially those deep-rooted perennial weeds. They come out much easier when the soil is nice and moist. So, but it also helps weeds to grow. So.
Right. I've noticed that myself, definitely.
Yes, we have found in a lot of our community gardens that the weeds have been growing much more vigorously than our crop plants. With those cool temperatures that we had early on and then the excessive rains, you know, weeds are so opportunistic and can grow so vigorously in that kind of weather. Whereas, you know, the things that we want to grow in our vegetable gardens are probably not doing quite as well. But we've had some nice warm weather recently, and things have dried out a little bit to the point that a lot of people are starting to water again. But we still have a lot of moisture deep down in the soil, which is perfect. So we could end up with a really great gardening season.
Maybe just a little delayed, or will it actually catch up, do you think?
I think things are going to catch up. You know, based on my own experiences, now I garden, we have a lot of community gardens in Racine, and so there, that's, of course, the southeastern portion of the state, and the climate there, I realize, is a little bit tropical compared to other parts of the state. But things have really been pushing the last 2 weeks. We have seen a tremendous amount of growth. And so things that were just sort of hanging out for a while are now ready to be harvested. So the cabbages, the lettuce, the radishes, the beets, you know, those cool season kinds of crops that we got in when we could, are now, you know, ready to be harvested. And the tomatoes and the things that we were able to plant around the first week of June, so they've only been in the ground for about 4 weeks, are really starting to produce. They're flowering, they've got fruit, they're, you know, doing pretty well.
I have to say, I have a lot of container tomatoes, and they're just going gangbusters all of a sudden.
Well, in the containers, you know, it's interesting. When you grow in raised beds or in containers or both, they tend to respond much more quickly to those warm temperatures because the soil warms up so much faster. I'm a big believer in monitoring soil temperatures because I know that a lot of my most favorite warm season crops really depend on those warm soil temperatures. So the tomatoes, the peppers, eggplant, squash, they really prefer those warm soil temperatures.
Right.
And some of my containers this past week have the soil temperature has been up close to 90 degrees.
Wow.
Which is, I was surprised at how hot it got to the point that I'm thinking, I need to provide some shade for my little pot, for the bottom part of the
pot.
Right,
and they dry out a lot faster,
And they do dry out. And that's what caught my attention, is that they were starting to dry out so quickly. But the plants are bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with containers, the bigger the plant, the more it transpires. And, of course, the larger the surface area of the soil, so the more you're getting in evaporation as well. So if the soil temperatures are getting up into the 80s, you know, low 90s, plus your plant is really bumped up in growth and you're getting a lot of leaf area, yeah, it's probably time to start watering some of those containers every day.
It didn't seem like we'd ever need to water there for
a
while.
I know. I was wondering if we were ever going to get summer.
Right. We're talking with Patty Nagai. She's UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Did the heavy rains that most of us got last month impact your garden? What's doing well in your garden this year? Or what isn't doing as well as you might have hoped? I bet Patty can help. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. Now, did those early rains and cool temperatures wipe out any plants? Because I know some plants, especially when they're seedlings, really don't like having cold, wet feet. And so I wonder, did anyone lose, say, peppers or tomatoes or eggplants, some of those early, or those crops that like really warm temperatures?
There were a lot of people, I think, who lost, based on the questions that I was getting early on, there were a lot of people that probably ended up replanting not just the vegetable plants, but some of their summer annual flowers that they put out as well. Because they brought things home from the garden center that were grown in a greenhouse in a very, you know, luxurious, protected environment with, you know, perfect conditions and slightly lower light levels. And they were so excited to get things out into the garden that they put things out without acclimating them to the outside, without hardening them off. And that process is so critical when you're looking at greenhouse grown plants, no matter what it is. If you take something from a protected environment and put it into full sun and expose it to wind and cold nights and, you know, then followed by full sun again, you're going to see a lot of damage. So we saw lots of pictures of various types of peppers and eggplant and black-eyed Susan vine and, you know, different types of flowers with totally bleached out leaves, you know, where all of the foliage just went sort of white on them. And one of the growers had contacted me to ask, you know, what's going on? Because people are bringing these plants back and they're thinking they're diseased.
And they were like, fine when they left the greenhouse.
They were perfect when they left here. I'm like, well, they just didn't get hardened off.
And so how long do you usually recommend acclimating plants? And it's not just from a greenhouse if we start seeds
indoors,
inside.
It's true for anything. And it generally takes for most annual flowers and vegetables, it takes at least 4 or 5 days. And it just depends on the weather and how you do it, but that's about the fastest you can acclimate it. And what you do is you bring it home, you might put it outside in the early morning for an hour or two, and then bring it into a protected environment. It might be your garage where the temperatures are a little bit cooler, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in your house. One of the other ways that you can help plants is to use floating row cover or a type of a light shade cloth to give it a little bit of protection. But you have to understand that there are so many different factors that are really hurting those plants. Just the wind alone can cause that kind of damage.
And we had some really strong winds.
A lot of wind. And then, you know, you combine that with the more intense sunlight because in a greenhouse, there is some filtered light. It's not really full sun. And a lot of the greenhouses do use shade cloth, and so, or they spray their houses with a light coat of paint to try and reduce some of that heat and direct sun. When you're putting it outside, you know, that's a huge difference. We see the same thing with houseplants. When people decide to move their houseplants out for the summer and they might have a beautiful potted hibiscus indoors, it might even be flowering indoors and looking great, and then they put it out on their patio and they think that they've had it in a bright location in their house.
But it's nothing compared to
outdoor sun. But it's really nothing compared to outdoor sun. When I'm teaching Master Gardener volunteers about acclimation, I always tell them that, you know, the brightest location in your house, the very brightest location that you can identify in your house is probably shadier than the shadiest place in your yard.
Wow.
And so, then, you know, if you take a light meter, you can show them that, you know, our eyes adjust so readily to different light levels. We're terrible monitors of what the light is really like. Plants are very sensitive to light. And so you need to protect them a little bit in the beginning. But after 4 or 5 days, you should be able to plant them out into the garden. But I also recommend monitoring the soil temperatures because in the early spring, those soil temperatures are so cold. Even in southeast Wisconsin, our soil temperatures didn't get up to, you know, 55-ish until that first week of June. Things were really delayed this year.
And that often says on seed packets or things, you know, plant when soil temperature is X. How do you test it?
You get a soil thermometer.
Okay.
And if you've got a thermometer at your house that you can put down into the soil 4 inches and get a reading, 3 to 4 inches, that will measure in that 45 to 75 degree range, you know, you can get an estimate with any kind of thermometer. I even say sometimes you can use meat thermometers.
Hmm.
You just need to wash it really well when you're done and perhaps not tell your spouse that
there
you did
go,
that.
Yeah.
But yes, you can use any kind of thermometer. Will work great for measuring that. But they make soil thermometers and they're very inexpensive. Hmm. For $4 or $5, you can get a really nice little steel thermometer that works beautifully. Very easy to use. And then just check the soil temperature. It's really interesting in the spring to see. The other thing that surprises people is in the fall, you know, there are so many things that we can grow in the fall because the soil is really warm.
Mm.
So even though the air temperatures may be cool, if you select plants that are frost tolerant, you can grow well into the fall. Even in, you know, some of the central and northern regions of Wisconsin, there are a lot of things that you can grow because the soil temperatures will stay warm for quite a long time.
Because it's really what's going on underground more than above ground.
It's all about protecting those roots and making sure they can bring up water and nutrients.
We're talking with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Lots more coming up talking about vegetables. And I see we have a caller with grapes and another one with peaches. So we'll be covering all kinds of gardening in just a moment. Right now is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Patty Nagai from UW Extension Horticulture for Racine County. And Patty, let's go to the phones and Judy in Burlington. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. I have a question. I'm having problems with peppers. Green, yellow, red. I even got a chocolate pepper once.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't make them grow. I get these little things about the size of golf balls. Now, I have a raised bed, and I was looking at something on the Internet, and it said I should use a fertilizer that's a 10-10-10
mm-hmm.
and fertilize them now. What is 10-10-10? Because I look at stuff in the garden shop, like in Menards
right.
or wherever, and I can't find one with that ratio. And so I really want some big peppers because, really, I just love those things.
Sure.
And if you're going to grow peppers, you certainly want to get good-sized fruit that tastes nice. And it sounds like you've tried a lot of different varieties. How big are the plants getting and the leaves? Are you getting nice, big, lush growth of plants and no fruit, or are the plants scrawny?
Right now, they're kind of scrawny, and then there's some leaves that are kind of brownish. They are yellowish, I guess you would say, turning to brown.
Well, that doesn't sound good.
No, and it's like I put garden soil in there this year that was supposed to be really good for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and every year I try to enhance the soil
okay.
so that it's not depleting itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that and you said this was in a raised bed, right?
Yes.
Raised bed. So one of the things that we do recommend for vegetable gardens of all kinds, whether you're in a raised bed or working in the ground, is to try to replenish the soil every year with a healthy dose of good quality compost, because that helps with drainage issues. It can help with some microbial issues. And so it's very beneficial to the plants with respect to nutrient uptake and keeping the root zone healthy. And so compost is a great way to improve your soil and help with pretty much any of the vegetable crops. But in particular with peppers, and this is true with, you know, tomatoes and eggplant, because they're very, very similar types of plants. They do have a higher fertility requirement to get to that fruiting and flowering and fruiting stage and to produce growth. But more often than not, especially if you've been replenishing the soil with, well, you said soil, but maybe not compost, and you've have you been fertilizing, or you weren't able to find the fertilizer that had been recommended?
No, I can't find the 10-10-10.
Well, that's a kind of a general recommendation, and there are fertilizers that are labeled 10-10-10, and all that means is 10% nitrogen, 10% potassium, and 10% phosphorus. So it's the three major elements that are included in most fertilizers. Those are the three that are required to be in those numbers on any label of fertilizer. What I would say is look for, it sounds like you might have a fertility issue, and you could, of course, take a soil sample and send it in and see what kind of fertility issue you have, but that will take a couple of weeks to get the results back for that. But if you come into the Extension office, our Master Gardener volunteers can help you with that process. But if you want to use a good quality general fertilizer to try and get your plants boosted a little bit, look for a fertilizer that, don't worry so much about the numbers, look for a fertilizer that says it is for flowering plants or specifically for tomatoes, because there are a lot of really nice tomato fertilizers out there. And because tomatoes and peppers are very close, it would work on peppers as well. And generally, you'll find that those types of fertilizers are a little bit lower in the first number. So they might be like a 10-15-15 or an 8-12-12 or something along those lines. And that's perfectly fine. If you give too much nitrogen to your plants, you'll end up with really lush growth and big leaves and tall, vigorously growing plants and very few flowers and fruit. So you're looking for a healthy balance. You need a good, strong root system. You need a good, strong plant. You need foliage to support the fruit, but you don't want so much foliage that it's interfering with fruit production.
All right. Great. Thanks for that call, Judy. And Andy in Oak Creek has another vegetable question. Let's go there. Hi, Andy. All right. Let's try Dave in Superior. Hi, Dave.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Well, we're just coming out of early to mid-spring.
A little cooler up there.
Well, our peonies haven't bloomed yet.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, you're a few weeks behind me, yes.
So, yes, I have a question about beans.
Okay.
We didn't plant our beans until mid-June because of it was
too cold.
Arctic. And they didn't come up for quite a while. When they did come up, we got some of them still had the bean shell attached. Mm-hmm. Some of them didn't. The primary leaves seemed to have been eaten out on many of the beanlet stalks before they hit the surface.
Right.
Have I got some kind of a grub going on down there?
There are so many different things that love to eat beans, and I'm going to ask you my favorite question. Do you know what your soil temperature was when you planted?
Well, I was probably up into the 60, 65
okay, that's
range.
Good. Okay.
I was watching that.
Wow. Okay, excellent. I'm so happy
you get
to
a gold
hear that.
Star,
you do
Dave.
Get the gold star for the day. You know, beans are warm season crops, with the exception of the English peas and the sugar snaps and those. But even those prefer warm soil temperatures in order to germinate. So the faster you can germinate your seeds, the less likely you are going to have any soil-borne sort of critter chewing on them. If the soil is cool, or if you don't quite have enough moisture during all the different stages of germination, you know, that's when you end up with that seed coat not quite dehiscing enough to get off of the cotyledons. The cotyledons can't push it off well enough. And then if the soil is cool, if the seedlings taste too long under the ground, that's when you start getting different little critters chewing on it. If you had foliage, if you were starting to see those true leaves and then something ate it, it could have been any number of insects. Probably not rabbit, because you probably wouldn't see anything at all left.
That would be what happened to my sugar snaps.
Yeah, they tend to get
were,
carried away.
There were a lot of baby bunnies and no sugar snaps.
Yeah, they just get carried away. So are these bush beans or pole beans that you're growing?
These are bush.
Bush beans. So the great thing about bush beans is that even up in Superior, it should not be too late to replant. And I wouldn't hesitate to do that, because a lot of those bush bean cultivars, if you read the seed packets and you know, do a little bit of homework before you buy seeds, some of those will mature in 40 days. And so the shorter the days to harvest is what you would want to look for. In our part of Wisconsin, we sow beans as late as August 15th. Bush beans, not pole beans, but we can get a good crop even if we sow the seeds as late as mid-August. And so it's not too late to sow again. If you have an insect problem under, you know, in the soil, it's possible that by sowing at a later date, that insect will have disappeared. Because a lot of times the life cycles of various beetles is such that you can miss them entirely by just sowing your seeds at a different time. The other thing with bush beans is that's a great crop to use for what we call succession planting, where you plant some of the beans 1 week, and then you come back in a week or two and you plant more, and then you come back in a week or two and you plant more, because bush beans tend to all come in to harvest all at the same time. You know, whereas pole beans you can harvest over a very long period of time, bush beans are really a one or two harvest kind of a crop, and then you really do need to pull them out and replant them. So you still have time. Try again.
Okay, well, we'll give it a shot.
All right, thanks,
all right,
Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks for that call, Dave. And you can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer today, will be happy to take your calls. She's also happy to take your emails when you send them to talk@wpr.org. And you can always post a question, comment, or a garden photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And Barb posted on our Facebook page, how long into the season should a person harvest asparagus plants? Any other advice you could offer for a wild asparagus patch?
Ooh, wild asparagus.
Wild
patch.
Asparagus.
Wild asparagus. My asparagus has gone wild. Does that count as wild asparagus? Asparagus can be harvested up until the time that it starts producing ferns. And if you let it go to the fern stage, then you probably should stop. And of course, that's going to vary a lot in different parts of the state. So, that period of time is so weather dependent, and it could be quite variable depending on where you live. But if you're still getting active spears coming up and you don't have a lot of them developing into ferns really quickly, because they tend to do that when it gets warmer, they tend to elongate very quickly.
Is it kind of like bolting, like mm-hmm. in cilantro
it's,
or something?
It's kind of like that. And so if you're still getting little spears that are tender and your temperatures are cool, then you can still harvest them. The key to really keeping an asparagus patch healthy is to keep it weed free. And that would be, with a wild asparagus patch, that's probably a little more difficult. But once they start going to the fern stage, if you can apply compost or a fertilizer, whether organic or synthetic, to help that fern growth develop and keep growing, that will help your crop for next year. The other key to growing really good asparagus is to make sure when you plant it that you don't harvest. And it's really better not to harvest until about the third year to give the asparagus a good chance to get those crowns and roots really well established in your soil. And keep it weed-free. Weeds in an asparagus bed are very difficult to control. So, you know, you need to really take care of those as soon as you start to see them.
And where is the best place in general to get starter asparagus? Is it, you buy the crowns?
You can buy the crowns, and most garden centers, nurseries, you can even find them at like the big box stores will have like boxes of 25 crowns or something like that. You can also order them online, and you might find that you have a much better selection of cultivars and much better prices, especially if you want to buy a larger number of them. So if you're looking to plant 100 crowns or 200 crowns, it's generally better to purchase them online from any of their numerous vegetable supply catalogs.
And for, say, a family of three or four, how many crowns might you want to plant to have enough to enjoy, you know, through the season?
It depends on how much you really like asparagus.
Let's say you like it quite a bit.
If you like it quite a bit, I would say you would need at least 100 crowns.
Wow.
I planted only 25 crowns, and I have had, and I did that several years ago, probably 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And I have a family of five, and we get enough asparagus that I'm able to serve it maybe four meals.
Wow.
Yeah. But my kids like asparagus, so.
All right.
I don't get enough to put up in the freezer.
Okay.
We eat it as fast as it comes
up.
Well,
I think that's the way to go anyway. Well, thanks for that question. Let's go next to Jolene in Two Rivers. Hi, Jolene.
Hi. How are you doing?
Doing well.
Good. I have a Saturn peach tree,
mm-hmm.
and I live in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. And its leaves this year have gotten pink, and then they turn red, and then they dry up and fall off.
I'm sorry. Do they curl a little bit?
Yes.
Yes. You have peach leaf curl.
Okay. And that I just treat with
There's a lime. If you're organic, there are some organic treatments that contain lime sulfur that you can use. And I believe there are some synthetic options also. You just need to make sure that it has peach leaf curl on the label and that you follow the directions very carefully. It is too late to treat this year. This is something you can look in your local garden centers and see which products are available for you now. But the time to treat is early in spring when the leaves are first emerging, because that's when the disease takes hold. In very severe cases, you can get a lot of defoliation, and it can also affect the fruit. Do you get fruit on your tree?
I have fruit. It's,
okay.
I mean, it's tiny, probably about grape size.
Okay.
And, I mean, how many times will my tree defoliate?
You mean in one season?
Yeah.
If you're getting new foliage now, it may not show signs of the disease, and that's great. You can help your tree along by making sure it stays well watered, and I'm not sure what the rainfall has been like in Two Rivers, but you need to make sure that it stays well watered throughout the summer for the best fruit production and to support that new foliage that's coming out. You might also want to consider using it's a little bit late for this as well, but to consider next year, in addition to having the treatment on hand for the peach leaf curl, that you might want to consider applying a fertilizer in the spring as well to help support the overall growth of the tree. Because when a tree defoliates, well, you've got two things going on. You've got a fruit-producing tree, and they tend to use a little bit more nutrients from the soil than a regular tree. And then you've also got a tree that has a disease issue and it has defoliated more than once. So it's using up a lot of its storage reserves in order to push those new leaves out. So you would want to apply a fertilizer in the spring as well. There are some great publications at the Learning Store that can help you make some good decisions about products that you might want to consider for your tree. On growing peaches. So go into the Learning Store and do the lawn and or the fruit and vegetable section, and then search for peaches and see what's listed for those types of controls. I'm thinking that there might be a dormant spray that you can use that can help with some disease issues with peaches as well, like a dormant oil that might help with some of those issues that you might have. So do a little bit of research and read up on it, and I hope that next year your tree is doing a lot better. I love peaches. It's by far my favorite fruit.
And a good peach is not easy to come by. I'm always surprised that we can grow peaches here, because I tend to think of them, you think Georgia peaches.
Right.
Are peaches tricky to grow?
Peaches are very tricky to grow here because we have Mother Nature working against us at every step of the way. And so in Southeast Wisconsin, we have a number of people who successfully grow peaches, but they always get peach leaf curl. Mm. It's a pretty common problem. And then the peaches tend to be very small and not quite as juicy as the peaches I remember from my childhood in the South. But still, they're peaches.
Right, right.
And that's a great thing. And it's a beautiful tree. And there are several varieties that have been bred specifically for northern climates. It's a crop that is not perfectly suited for Wisconsin, but under the right circumstances, yes, we can grow it.
And worth a try.
And it's worth a try, even if it's only as an ornamental basis. So a lot of times what happens is when the flowers come out, we get a frost and it knocks the flowers out. So
thanks for that call, Jolene. And Satya wrote on Facebook, is it still worth harvesting cilantro after it's flowered? This happens to me every year and I never get any cilantro. What can I do to get a lot of leaves and delay flowering?
This is a chronic problem for people who really love their cilantro. And the solution that I've come up with, I have definitely use cilantro that started flowering. I always taste it first to see if it is still tasting okay. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that the flavor will change. And so it has a slightly different, it's not that it's a bad flavor, it's just a different flavor that develops when the flowers start in cilantro. What I recommend for people who really want a nice harvest of cilantro is to do the same thing I was recommending with the beans, where you do succession planting and you just schedule it. Every week you plant cilantro seeds somewhere and you spread it out over the course of the summer. The day length affects how the cilantro flowers, and there are some newer cultivars of cilantro that say they can tolerate the longer days and the warm temperatures. But I find that pretty much every variety that I've planted, it will still bolt at some point. So keep seeding it, harvest it, and then seed again.
And does it help to pinch off the flowers as soon as you see them, or does it not really matter?
No, okay. Once it starts that flowering process, it's going to continue on and do it. Now, if you are collecting, if you're a seed saver, you should let some of those plants go ahead and develop to maturity and collect the seed. If you let them develop seed and you don't collect the seed, you will have cilantro forever in that spot, because it will, the seed does overwinter in the soil and it'll come up again next year. But the only cure I've really found for that bolting is to just make sure that you're planting on a regular basis, and you just need to, every Saturday morning, go out and plant some more cilantro.
Your weekly cilantro appointment.
Yes.
And is cilantro something that grows well in a pot inside, or is it mostly outdoors?
It does like full sun. It'll grow much better and faster if it's in full sun, but it certainly grows very nicely in a very bright kitchen window. I put it in a lot of my containers. I put it in the larger containers that I use for tomatoes and peppers. I have cilantro plants in almost all of those. And I've already sown cilantro 3 times to try and, you know, keep that process going. But a lot of mine is already gone to seed, that first planting.
Wow, even with the cool weather we've been having.
Even with the cool weather, because it's a day length issue.
Well, thanks for that call, or that email, Satya. And let's go next to John in Red Granite. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm relatively new to gardening, and I'm developing some property here in the middle of Wisconsin, which was, from what I gather, an ancient beach for an ancient glacier. And as a result, it's just incredibly sandy. So I'm thinking, with a peculiar soil, there's probably some peculiar approaches that I you know, can't find info online, that sort of thing, that maybe you can, you know, give me some ideas or suggestions. You know, do I need to get seeds that are used to this kind of soil? Am I wasting my time?
Sure. And actually, I have to say, John, I think a lot of Wisconsin gardeners with very heavy clay soil would
be jealous.
Would be happy to trade places with you, because really, in either case, but certainly I think with the sandy soil, it's a little easier. It's all about amending the soil, right, Patty?
Exactly. And, you know, that central sands region of Wisconsin is a phenomenal area for growing vegetables, if that's what you're interested in growing. You know, we have a huge vegetable industry in the central sands area. You should, you know, take advantage of the things that really like that sandy soil. Any kind of root crop is fabulous in those sandy areas. But if you're talking about growing, you know, shrubs, perennials, flowers, and that sort of thing, what you have to take into consideration is the watering capacity. You know, when you're working in a sandy soil, it just requires so much more moisture. So things that might prefer a really highly organic, moist soil, maybe the ferns and the hydrangeas and things like that, not so great there without a lot of maintenance to make sure that they stay well hydrated. But for vegetables, gosh, you can grow almost anything there. It's just fabulous.
Oh, wow. It just looks so sandy to me.
Yes.
You just think beach.
When
you think beach,
oh,
you don't sandy. Think, you know, the source of your cornucopia.
Yeah, right. Well, are you planning, is this primarily vegetables that you're interested in? Or
yeah,
you...
right.
Okay.
That's what it is, you know, and I want vegetables and... I've just transplanted some tomatoes, but mm-hmm. other than that, I got a late start, and I kind of thought, all right, well, I use some potting soil and sort of use the ground as my container. You know, I kind of create spots of just the potting soil.
Right.
Just to figuring it needs, you know, some more oomph to get these things going. Does that sound like a strategy worth doing?
It's
is it a waste of soil? Or?
No, it's not a waste of soil or... one of the things that we always recommend is compost, because compost is like that miracle substance. It, of course, provides a tremendous amount of organic matter and helps sandy soils retain moisture. And then when you use it in clay soils, it helps to provide better drainage in addition to the higher organic matter. So compost is something that you can never have too much of, and you can continue to add it every year and make the mess. Make the best out of your sandy soil. You can buy, you know, you can purchase some good quality topsoil. Whenever you put soil into your garden, though, you're introducing new things, you know, new potential weed seeds or diseases, you know, that sort of thing. But if you're trying to, you know, give it a little more oomph, as you said, then that is one possible way to do that. You could consider doing raised beds and bringing in a compost soil mixture, which would be kind of like the best of both worlds, because you would have that beautiful drainage underneath and then a little bit heavier organic matter on top to get the root system started. But keep in mind that most of these vegetable plants, with the exception of the greens, you know, the tomatoes, the peppers, all of these things have very deep root systems. So they're definitely going to be going down into your soil, into your native soil, you know, because they can go down 3 feet easily.
John, what county are you in?
Shara.
Okay, because just like Patty is mm-hmm. the horticulture educator for Racine County, mm-hmm. I'm assuming Shawnee County would also have an educator?
There is an educator there. I think it's a multi-county educator. I'm blanking out on who it is.
So that person would have
right,
really
they,
good information right. about growing in that particular
And there are master gardeners in that area also. So if you contacted your local county extension office, they may have some even better suggestions on how to deal with your soil. But I would definitely say don't give up. I think
oh, no.
that you are in a prime location for growing all sorts of wonderful vegetables. And sweet potatoes grow great in the Central Sands region. Potatoes, green beans, these are major agricultural crops in your area. So, you know, don't be whining about your sandy soil.
Wow. Well, thanks. I was thinking you were going to tell me to get used to eating pine and tall grasses.
No, you just keep like growing.
You lucked out, John. Well, we'll want to report back after
Absolutely.
Your first full growing season. Thanks
Absolutely.
For that call. And let's go next to Terry in Green Bay. Hi, Terry.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to ask Patty a question on, I have an electric ground or dirt sterilizer. It's manufactured, I think, in Milwaukee, and it does a yard at a time. You heat it up, you know, you can set your thermostat 190, 200 degrees for
wow.
about 6 hours. And the reason I do this, I want to use it with a mixture of half of the black ground, you know, the
mm-hmm.
ground itself.
Topsoil. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with some commercial bagged mulch.
Okay.
Some Fafhard, a 52 mix.
Okay.
And I was wondering, by heating up my soil,
mm-hmm.
by sterilizing or steaming this soil,
mm-hmm.
does it destroy micronutrients in the soil is at somewhat of a disadvantage. You know, and I'm doing this to kill the weed seeds.
Right. And it will kill everything in the soil, but the micronutrients are elements. Those are chemical elements. They're not going to be altered. The nitrogen can be altered considerably when you sterilize soil in that fashion, but it just, you know, it changes form. You might lose some of it. There's really no need to sterilize the Fafard, though, because that's already a clean soil mixture, soilless mixture. So if it's just the topsoil that you're interested in killing the weed seeds, it will definitely kill the weed seeds, but it's not going to alter the chemical nature of the soil. So the micronutrients and those chemicals will still be in the soil.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for that call, Terry. And you can also join in by calling 1-800-642-1234 or sending an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk, talking with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. More in just a moment. We are talking about gardening with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And coming up on Monday at 11, we'll hear from folks at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection about how to be smart consumers. They'll also let us know what scams have been reported recently in Wisconsin so we can avoid them. And Patty, we have quite a few folks on the line that would like to join the conversation, so let's go right back to the phones. And Bud in Wausau is up next. Hi, Bud.
Hi, good morning. I love your program, especially on gardening. I don't have a garden where I am anymore, but I do have some mushrooms growing in our yard here in Wausau. It's quite sandy soil. They're growing in the grass where we cut a maple tree down about 8 or 10 years ago and ground out the stump. And, of course, a lot of the shavings in the stump is still under the grass. This is in an area of the grass where it gets about 4 or 5 hours of direct sunlight every day, but we're getting some nice brown mushrooms, and they seem to, this is about the third batch now with this wet spring and summer that we've been, and I'm wondering if they're fit to eat. They're kind of about the size of a half dollar and flat on the top. They're brown, very thin stems, and they're not crowned like the white mushrooms that we see so often around. But does this sound like a mushroom that's edible? Can you help me?
I'm guessing that Patty's not going to want to have responsibility for that.
Mushrooms are I love to eat mushrooms, and I always purchase them at the grocery store because I am not a mushroom expert, and I would not answer that.
So is there someone that can answer that?
You know, if you take a picture of the mushroom and send it to Brian Huddleston at the PDDC clinic,
the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic.
It's interesting because Brian actually won't ID them positively either, but he has someone that he forwards these to for identification. So I'll give you my mushroom spiel that I always give people when they bring mushrooms in or they call and ask me about these types of things. There are so many different types of mushrooms growing in Wisconsin, and a lot of them are wood-borne mushrooms. They grow on the dying, decomposing wood from a fallen tree or the root system or something like that. There are a lot of them. And some of them are incredibly poisonous. And it's just too risky to try. And not being a mycologist or a mushroom expert, I would not even attempt to do that. Even in real life, if the mushroom were sitting here in front of me and I had books in front of me, I still wouldn't tell you it was okay to eat it.
Because, the gamble is a pretty big
It's a pretty big gamble. But if you really want to know what kind of mushroom it is and, you know, what's popping up in your yard, you can take a picture of it. And it needs to be pretty close up. You need to have pictures of the gills underneath the cap and a whole picture of it and be able to explain, just like you just did, of where you found it, and send it to Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic.
And actually, Rachel Owens, our on-air producer, just dug up that information, so you can call the clinic at 608-262-2000. 2863, or you can email that either just a message or email that photo to Brian. His email is bdh@plantpath, so plantpath.wisc.edu, and he can forward it on to his mushroom specialist.
His secret mushroom specialist who can answer that question. See, most of the time when I get mushroom questions,
just
they really...
1, 2, 3.
Brian can send that on.
Right. And then most of the time when I get questions, they really want to know how to get rid of them. And they're, if you want to get it out of your yard, the only way is really to just keep raking them up because there are no chemical controls for it. And as long as the tree roots are there and the conditions are right, you'll still get them.
And I have to say, in France, you can take mushrooms that you've harvested to any pharmacist.
And
they will identify them for you because it's such a part of the culture.
Try taking it to your local drugstore and see what they say.
See what they say. Well, thanks for that call, bud.
Thanks.
Let's go now to Lori in West Salem. Hi, Lori.
Good morning. I have a question about raspberries. I'm not sure what type we have, but they start bearing fruit in August. Mm-hmm. And last year was the third year, I believe, that we picked, and we try to grow organic, so I've put nothing on them. But last year I noticed that something was eating from the tip of the ripe raspberry down to where it holds on to the plant. And I never saw anything on the plants. I did see Japanese beetles, like, on the leaves, but I never actually saw something doing the eating. And it was, you know, someone asked, well, was it birds in it or something? But it's, like, every single plant. So I'm thinking it's some sort of insect or something, and I was wondering if you have any insight.
Well, sure, yeah, but you're talking about them eating the fruit, not the leaves, or
correct?
The, okay,
yes.
So they're
so
actually
it ruins
eating the fruit.
The chance to take this beautiful raspberry and eat it myself.
I'm sorry to hear that. That's always disappointing when you're trying to harvest fruit and you go out to pick it the next day and it's gone or ruined,
right?
Half eaten. There are a lot of things that like to eat raspberries, and you might not ever see them. Birds will eat the raspberries right off the canes, no question about it. Rabbits and chipmunks will eat them also. Then there are a number of different insects that will eat them. The Japanese beetles focus mostly on the leaves, but the brown marmorated stink bug will eat raspberries.
The actual fruit.
They will eat that, as well as, I don't think the earwigs. I'm trying to think of things that are night feeders that come out that would eat the fruit. There are probably quite a few of them. There are different types of beetles that will eat it. The Asian lady beetle will actually eat raspberry fruit also, but you would see those on the plant. But there are a lot of animals that would come out at night and do that. For organic production, you know, one of the best things that you can do is once the fruit is formed and you know that pollination has taken place and you have good quality fruit growing, you could buy some floating row cover and cover the entire plant with floating row cover. And floating row cover is lightweight enough that it allows water to go through as well as sunlight. It doesn't decrease the sunlight, so the fruit can still develop, and then you can harvest clean fruit without having it. Now, if it's something that's crawling up from the bottom, that may not help. But that is one of the organic options for producing clean fruit. For raspberries, there's not a lot that you can do other than covering in order to protect them, because of course you're harvesting them. So even if you wanted to spray an organic option there, you know, the days to harvest is too close, so it would be a problem.
Well, I know that entomologist Phil Pelletieri, who's on the show quite often, recommends if you're having trouble with some kind of insect pest that you can't figure out what it is, go out with a flashlight at night.
At night, and
because often you'll be able to see them doing their dirty work when you wouldn't be able to see them otherwise. So that might be an idea.
That's actually, you know, a really good idea, because until you know what it is that you're dealing with, it's kind of hard to control it. And if it is something that's crawling up from the bottom, then it, you know, covering the top of the plant's not going to help. But if it's birds, you can put bird netting or floating row cover over the top of the plants and protect them that way.
With the cool, wet spring, thanks for that call, by the way, Lori. With the cool, wet spring, Patty, how have fruits like raspberries or strawberries or currants, you know, the small fruit, mm-hmm. have they been impacted by the cool, wet spring and early summer?
We have a pretty big raspberry patch in one of our community gardens, and it's loaded with fruit, or at least the summer bearing are loaded. We've got some fall bearing that haven't produced yet. But they tend to have really lush growth, you know, so there's also a lot of vegetation. So it seems to have pushed the vegetation. But they don't seem to be too badly delayed.
Mm-hmm. My black raspberries are looking really good this year.
Nice.
And it's usually just about mid-July that they're mm-hmm. ready. So coming up in a couple weeks. And,
now, do you have problems with any critters getting your...
No, I really haven't.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm lucky that way. And just quickly, we had an email from Julie in Heartland. She's had troubles. She thinks that crows were pulling up her beans going back to that earlier call.
Sure.
And so she used a floating row cover when she starts seeing the sprouts coming up, and she keeps them covered until they have a few real mm-hmm. leaves, and then it's safe to uncover. So it could be crows, too.
It could be crows. And birds will do a huge amount of damage to beans. And in some areas, and in urban environments especially, when you're planting bush beans, you can cover them with the floating row cover as soon as you seed, and you can leave that on there as long as you've left enough flexibility in the fabric so that the plants can grow unhindered underneath them. You can leave that on there until you're ready to harvest, and you will have the cleanest beans you've ever seen.
That's great. Well, thanks for that note, Julie. And Patty Nagai is our Garden Talk guest. She is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. It's a lot of fun to get out in the garden and dig in the dirt. And this time of year, there's a lot to get done, especially when it seems like the cool, wet weather has been perfect for a record-breaking crop of weeds. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Friday means Garden Talk, and it's always great when one of our wonderful UW Extension Horticulture and Agriculture agents comes by. Patty Nagai is a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, and she's happy to help solve your gardening problems so you can have a fun and fruitful gardening year. Patty, always great to have you with us.
Thank you, Judith. I'm happy to be here.
And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a question, comment, or gardening photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And we have been talking about the cool, wet spring, and we mentioned the weeds. What are some good techniques for getting rid of weeds, whether it's in a small area or a much more extensive area? Annual weeds, then there are those perennial ones too.
Well, they each have their own, you know, challenges getting rid of them. So with all of the weeds, one of the biggest things that you can do is to make sure they don't flower and set seed, because most of them have a huge capacity for seed production. And wheat seeds, amazingly enough, tend to last for years and years and years in the soil.
Just our luck.
Just keep coming up, you know, year after year. So don't let them go to seed. If you can't get them out right away, at least, you know, get the flowers and seed heads cut off so that you don't get that seed production. You know, there are some organic methods for killing weeds. The best one, of course, is hand pulling. But some weeds, you know, you just can't remove that way. The creeping Charlie ground ivy is almost impossible to remove by pulling, as is bindweed. Bindweed is in the morning glory family. It's a perennial. You know, the things like that, you really need to take a chemical approach if you're going to be serious about getting rid of it. And there are so many different products. The first step is always to identify the weed and to make sure that you're treating it appropriately. If you have crabgrass, it's going to die anyway because it's an annual. Hmm. If you have quackgrass and you think it's crabgrass, it's not going away. And that's one that has some huge challenges because it's very difficult to kill. So the weeds, you know, they can really take over quickly, and it's a good idea to know what you're dealing with and try to address the problem as early as possible so that they don't spread too badly.
All right, let's go back to the phones and Evan in Madison. Hi, Evan.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I recently got really obsessed with growing fruit. And so I bought a couple blueberry bushes and I put them in the ground, and the only thing I know about caring for them is that the soil needs to be kind of on the acidic side.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from that, I know nothing about their their watering needs or pruning or what I can expect from, you know, in the first year and in years to come.
Right.
And then my only other question was, can you recommend a good tart cherry tree for this part of the state? And I'll just take my answers off the phone here.
All right. Thanks for that call, Evan. And so, what, as Evan said, blueberries need acidic soil. What does that mean exactly, Patty?
So blueberries are a plant that doesn't just, you know, want acidic soil. It really has to have acidic soil or it won't be able to take up the nutrients that it needs. So they do have quite a nutrient requirement for not just fruit production, but just to produce their leaves and to maintain healthy growth. And so if the soil is in that 4 to 5 range, blueberries are really pretty happy, you know, and that is incredibly acidic. If you're getting up into the 5 to 6 range, then they can grow pretty well. You might have to do some additional nutrient applications to, you know, keep them growing really, really well. And so they can grow really well, you know, if it's like 5 or 5.5. But if you're getting above 6, and 6 is still acidic, mm-hmm. 6 is still considered acidic, but if your pH is above 6, that's really not acidic enough for blueberries. And then, of course, if you're getting above 7, that's getting into the alkaline ranges, and blueberries will be incredibly unhappy. So generally what happens in the first year is that the blueberries look beautiful, no matter what kind of soil you have, because they're maintained in their potting mix. Even if you've got them in the ground, they're still growing within their original soil mix and doing well. The second year, they might start to look a little yellow. They're not growing so vigorously. By the third year, in really alkaline soils, they'll be dead. They just can't survive. And so blueberries are not, for a good portion of Wisconsin, they're not really a recommended fruit crop. But if you know that you have acidic soil and you just need to, you know, apply a little bit of extra nutrition to get them to grow well, they're a fun crop to grow. They're very beautiful. They're beautiful shrubs. They don't really require a huge amount of maintenance. Pruning is not really necessary. They sort of maintain themselves in a very nice little shape. It's the nutrient and the soil acidity that are the biggest issues. And yes, they do require regular moisture, so they need to be maintained in a semi-moist state throughout the growing season and well into fall. We don't have a huge amount of information on blueberries because it's not a crop for most of Wisconsin. And I hate to do this, but you can go to the University of Minnesota. And they have a great fact sheet on growing blueberries that'll give you some more information about how to grow blueberries.
And Evan was also asking about a tart cherry,
and I don't grow cherries. There are listings of cultivars that will grow well in different parts of Wisconsin, though. We do have a publication on growing cherries in Wisconsin, and that's where I would send you, because there are some factors to consider before planting a cherry tree. Soil type is, again, important. You want to make sure that the soil is very well drained. One of the bigger problems that we have with cherry trees in some areas of Wisconsin are Phytophthora root rot and crown rot issues. It's really common. So before planting a cherry tree, you need to make sure that it is that you have the soil and the location suitable for it. So go to the Learning Store, learningstore.uwex.edu, and go to the fruit section and search for cherry, and you will find two different publications. One which gives you everything you ever wanted to know about cherry trees, including all of the different cultivars that are suitable for our area.
Great.
And it'll tell you about insects and training the tree and all of that. And then there's another publication on pest management for homeowners. And so you should be able to find both of those publications and get all of the information you need. And it's really best to research this before you plant. And that selection of cultivar depends on where you are and what kind of soil you have.
Mm-hmm. And probably what kind of space you have for you as well.
Well, that's true, too. Cherry trees can get quite large.
Well, and we had an email from Kevin that's kind of related. A local nursery has some potted fruit trees on sale. Can they still be planted at this time of year?
Oh, absolutely. Trees, anything that's potted up, containerized right now, believe me, those plants would be ecstatic to be planted in the ground and out of those containers.
Right.
And so, yes, we still have, well, in my part of the state, we still have several months of very wonderful root growing opportunity. And
oh,
that's what you're most concerned about. Is
that they're well established.
That they get well established in the ground prior to ground freeze. And depending on where you are, that might occur in late October. It might not occur until December. But we still have several really good months of root growing, and that's what you're most concerned about. So prepare your hole. Make sure that you've got a nice, big, wide hole. Don't plant anything too deeply. You want to make sure that it's no deeper than the root flare for the tree, no matter what kind of tree it is. Mm. And keep it well watered until the ground freezes to make sure that it's got enough growth opportunity.
Great. And now you said potted trees, but is that the same for bare root or not?
I doubt that you would be able to find bare root material at this point. Bald and burlap, though, is very similar to containerized as far as getting them in the ground. You know, those would have been dug much earlier in the spring, and it's just a kind of a different sort of container.
All right. Well, thanks for those questions. And let's go next to Kevin in Middleton. Hi, Kevin.
Howdy. We planted some sweet peppers and tomatoes 3-4 weeks ago that were on closeout, of course. And the sweet peppers are showing almost like the brownish curling tips on the leaves. Several of them are losing their fruit. The pepper or the tomatoes are not showing that same thing, almost like what the blight or whatever
was
a couple of years ago. So I'm just wondering if there's something I can put on there, assuming it's bacteria or fungus of some sort.
I'm not sure that that's a foliar fungal problem. It sounds more like a root issue. When you planted those peppers, were they pretty tightly root bound? No,
did
the roots look good? Did they look healthy and white?
They looked all healthy, yeah.
Okay. Now, tell me about your watering practices.
Recently, of course, we haven't had much opportunity to water because it's been flooding.
Okay.
So, before all the water came and we had to build an ark, we had to water, and we did every 2 days.
Okay. But the plants themselves, they've been flooded with the heavy rains?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, they were outside during that, yes. So.
Are they in the ground or are they in a container?
They're in ground.
Okay. Well, one of the things that it kind of sounds like is root rot, you know, that they might have some sort of root, you know, an uptake issue. And the only thing that you can really do about that is to stop the rain and not water so much. And they need to, peppers really, they like well-drained soil. They do need moisture, but go maybe a little bit lighter on your watering and pray for some nice, hot, sunny days so that they can dry out a little bit. If you want, for curiosity purposes, dig one of them up and look at the root system and see what's going on down there and if they're actually growing or if the roots are kind of brown and mushy and maybe don't smell so great. If you have a root rot issue that's already set in, they may not recover from it. You could try replanting them in a different part of the garden. You could try, you know, incorporating some a lot of compost to try and remediate that area a little bit. Or you could just wait it out and see if they recover. I don't know that there's really anything, if that's what it is, I don't know that there's really anything you could do about it. It's not like you can spray anything to handle a root rot problem.
Would there, if it is root rot, would it make sense to just get rid of those plants and maybe replant? I know a lot of nurseries still have.
Yeah, you know, then that's not really a bad option if you want to check out some of your local garden centers. It's really not too late to plant a lot of things. If you find peppers that still look, the plants still look really healthy and they're not totally root bound. Sometimes when they stay in the little containers too long, they get overly stressed and they don't produce very well. But it's possible that you could still get some peppers in the ground and get some production out of them. But, you know, you might want to just dig one of them up and look at the roots and see what it looks like. If you're still undecided and you can't, you know, if you're not sure that's what it is, you can always send a sample in, to your local extension office or to the PDDC clinic. If you send it to the clinic, there will be a charge. Dr. Huddleston does have a clinic fee that he charges to do a disease analysis. And for what that fee is, you could probably buy a lot of peppers. Right. So,
and the plant, that was the plant disease diagnostic.
The plant disease diagnostic clinic, right, on campus.
Well, good luck with that, Kevin. And we had an email from Pete in La Crosse. He says, my tomatoes are organic, and for the first time in several years, I'm getting an early yellowing blight of the lower leaves. Mm-hmm. I used an organic fungus spray thinking it is fungal. This is a pretty common problem, he thinks, but he says it's not doing the job this time. Any ideas on how to save the plants? He says if it's unchecked, it will brown and yellow the whole plant.
Well, if it is a fungal disease, if it's a leaf spot disease, and there are several different diseases that can affect tomatoes, typically this time of year we start to see early blight and septoria. Both of those we have really excellent one-page fact sheets on at the at our horticulture site. So that site is hort.uwex.edu. You can go to the Wisconsin horticulture site and look for the fact sheets on those two diseases and get some great information on how to control them, both organic or synthetic. One thing to keep in mind is if it is a fungal disease, you can remove those lower leaves and discard them. Make sure that they get out of the garden and not in your compost pile. You can change your watering methods so that you're not splashing soil particles up onto those lower leaves to get the diseases started in the first place. The organic options for fungal prevention work well, but you have to keep in mind that they are preventative only.
Mm-hmm. And so once you see it,
leaves are infected, those control options are not going to kill the disease, but they will protect new foliage from being infested, but you must follow the label directions exactly for them to work correctly. And for with the organic options, that means very frequent spraying. The other thing I would suggest is that perhaps it's not a disease issue. It sounds like you've seen this before, though, and you've had it identified as a disease, but with general yellowing, it might be a nitrogen deficiency. And we see that often with cool soils and heavy rains when the nitrogen gets depleted in the soil because it gets transformed into another form that the plants can't take up. And so it could be that you need to apply a fertilizer that contains a little bit of nitrogen. And there are some great organic options out there for fertilizers. There are even some nice slow-release organic fertilizers now that you can use in container plants as well as in the ground to help keep the nutrients kind of in a steady state throughout the growth of the plant.
Patty Nagai is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. This is Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Let's go back to the phones and Valerie in Grafton. Hi, Valerie.
Hi. I have a question about rhubarb and asparagus that I planted this spring. I'm just not really sure what to do with it because I know you're not supposed to harvest either of those the first year. So do I cut it back or do I just let it grow?
Just let it grow. Another? Yes, okay. Let it grow. So with the asparagus, when it develops those beautiful ferns, that's the time that you would want to give it a little bit of fertilizer boost. And as I was just mentioning with the tomatoes, if you're doing organic fertilizers, there are just all sorts of organic options now for fertilizers. And you're looking for something that's kind of balanced with nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. You want to make sure that you've got a nice balanced fertilizer to help those ferns develop to be the best they can possibly be. So now would be the time to do that. And yes, you don't want to harvest. And depending on how vigorous your plants are growing, you might not want to harvest those next year either. So you might want to give them another year. If you really want to establish a very healthy and vigorously growing asparagus patch, you might want to just let it go for another year and then do the same thing next year. When those ferns start to turn brown this year, that's when you would cut them back. So you can cut them back later in the fall when they start to turn brown, and that way you will maximize the amount of energy that goes into those crowns and the roots to develop underneath that will give you the better production in years to come.
And what about that rhubarb?
Rhubarb is pretty easy. You know, you could probably harvest rhubarb and it would still come back. Rhubarb is, I always laugh when I look at all the official recommendations for rhubarb because most of the time the questions I get about rhubarb are, how do I get rid of it? It's growing way too well. I want to share it with everybody because I have so much rhubarb. So rhubarb is really pretty straightforward. During this first year of growth, you can put a little balanced fertilizer on it, maybe just once, just to make sure that it's getting enough nutrients. A lot of people will recommend cutting the flowers off to make sure that the roots are still getting all of the good energy that they need to establish for long-term harvest capacity. So you might want to cut those flower stalks off when they appear, but leave the leaves alone. Don't cut it back until fall when you start to get that first frost, and then you can cut it back. And then even though it is a perennial crop and we like to get them well established with the rhubarb, next spring you could harvest some of the petioles next year and eat them. I would not harvest all of them, but you could definitely harvest some of them and enjoy that.
All right. Thanks for that call, Valerie. And let's take a very quick call from Connor in Blair. Hi, Connor.
Hi, I have a very quick question.
Great.
I'm growing tomatoes and peppers, and I've seen on the internet a lot about using Epsom salt is like the saving grace for tomatoes and peppers, and that it helps them produce more fruit and blooms. And is this kind of true? I don't know if you have any experience with this at all.
It could be true. you know, our soils in Wisconsin typically, except for that sandy area, typically are very high in magnesium. And so in our area, you know, depending on what your soil test reads, it may not have any effect at all. So all Epsom salts are, it's magnesium sulfate. And if you have a magnesium deficiency, then yes, Epsom salts can help with that. And tomatoes definitely need magnesium to develop healthy fruit. There's no question about that. It is one of the major elements for plant development. But
I thought that salt is not good.
Oh, we know fertilizers are salts.
Okay.
So all fertilizers are salts. They, you know, that's the way elements balance themselves out is by making salts.
Hmm,
and so when you're looking at any kind of fertilizer, it's going to be ammonium nitrate, ammonium sulfate, magnesium sulfate. It's always two elements balancing each other out. And so they are salts. And that's why when you over-fertilize, for example, in a pot, in a container, you can see those salt crystals developing on the sides of the pot. That can be either from your water that contains perhaps too much calcium and magnesium, or it could be from too much fertilizer.
Well, there you go. Thanks for that call, Connor. And Patty Nagai, thanks so much for spending the time with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It always flies by, doesn't it?
I'm always challenged by your listeners' questions.
I know. And well, and they're used to being able to throw anything and everything at you. So thank you so much. Patty Nagai is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. Coming up on Monday, we'll hear from folks at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection about how to be smart consumers. And coming up today at 2 on Science Friday, Ira Flatow takes a look at how Benjamin Franklin's entrepreneurial spirit fueled American innovation then and now. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us today for Garden Talk. I hope you'll stay tuned to the Ideas Network for many more interesting and informative programs. Have a good weekend.